From KCUR News, this is Casey Currents reporting news and culture in Kansas City's diverse communities and beyond. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith. On this week's show, the Midwest struggles through its worst drought in decades.
This corn right here is dead. And you can see by the cracks in the ground how dry it is.
A local track star prepares to cross the pond for the 2012 Summer Olympics.
I mean, obviously, I know God gave me a gift to run. And I'm really determined, I'm hungry to be on the top. And I think that pretty much plays a huge role.
We break down the Kansas school finance lawsuit.
Now it has become outcomes-based education. And so the plaintiffs will argue that suitable funding is the amount of funding it takes.
Listen up for KC Currents just after this hour's news. This is KC Currents. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith. KC Currents is KCUR's weekly magazine show. We use voices, stories, and sound to take you to neighborhoods around the region.
Drought has spread this week along a wide swath of the country. But along the Arkansas River, drought has been torching crops, depressing tourism, and threatening municipal water supplies for months. Our story from Frank Morris with Harvest Public Media begins where the drought does, at the Arkansas headwaters, high in the Rocky Mountains of Colorado, and follows the river to its demise on sunbaked Kansas prairie.
The Arkansas River starts here, about 10 miles north of Leadville, as a trickle running off some of the highest peaks in the continental United States.
11,002. Yep. And it's all downhill from here.
Gary Hanks is water commissioner up here. He's an affable, gray-haired fellow, retired school teacher, who's now in charge of a precious commodity, one that comes down from the mountains, normally.
You would see some snow, especially the higher up, you would see snow-capped peaks and water rushing down.
And this year's just kind of dribbling
down. Yeah, it's not even dribbling down. I can't see any right now.
And the drought intensifies just downstream.
So I'm going to take this pipe wrench, and I'm going to shut this guy off.
Hanks and I have come to a head gate, two big steel valves set in concrete at a bend in this rocky trout stream. One's already closed. Now they both are. And a rancher downstream is out of luck.
He wasn't getting very much to start with. Now he's not gonna get any.
Because every drop of water in this river is spoken for. And just downstream from here, it's used mainly for tourism, fishing, and rafting.
Dig it in, friends. Dig it in, dig it in, dig it in, dig it in, dig it in. Bump! Nice job.
Andy Ninus is guiding a rubber raft full of tourists in orange helmets through Royal Gorge, where the Arkansas River is cut through 1,000 feet of pink granite. He runs Echo Canyon, a big outfitter.
And that was Wall Slammer.
Rafting is the summertime of skiing when you're talking about Colorado.
Ford Two Heart.
Rafting's big business on the Arkansas, and business is down. Ninus blames the forest fires more than the water levels, but the river is low.
So here we have the South Canyon Ditch, and just downstream in a moment we have the hydraulic ditch, and essentially the Arkansas River is just a little bit smaller right now.
Wow, Ford Hard, Ford Hard. And I am probably going to have to get out and push. Ford Hard, let's keep going hard, hard.
Sorry, all the water in the river is allocated based on seniority. The older the water claim, the higher the priority. Canyon City, at the mouth of the Royal Gorge, where the river slows and sets off across the plains, holds one of the best claims. But even here, Bob Hartzman with the Municipal Water Department worries that their river water will soon be cut off.
Our water rights have never been called out. That just shows you how things have changed over these last 100 years.
When the call does come, it'll be from 50 miles downstream near Avondale, Colorado, where agriculture rules.
You see cows that are starting to trot and run towards us?
They're in a hurry.
Dan Henrich, standing here in a faded cowboy hat and freshly won rodeo belt buckle, runs Longhorn cattle out here on the wide open plains just east of the Rockies. It's desert dry normally, and this year's been doubly arid and brutally hot. Pale brown, sun-broiled scrublands surround this valley, yet this pasture is green. fields of thirsty watermelon and corn flourish a few miles away, all thanks to the river.
We are standing at the confluence or the head gates of the Highline Canal on the Arkansas River.
Here, most of what's left of the Arkansas River spills into rusty steel gates and pours down a straight, grass-lined canal. The Highline holds a very old claim and is still running strong, but most irrigation canals are dry, leaving miles and miles of crops to wither.
This corn right here is dead, and you can see by the cracks in the ground how dry it is.
Travel 100 miles east down the river, and you'll find Dale Mock, who runs a big farming and cattle operation on the scorched plains of Lamar, Colorado, the canal that four generations of his family have relied on for irrigation. Dried up last month.
The Fort Lyon Canal is a canal that started in 1860. This is the first time that we went to zero before the 4th of July. That's just something that's just in 152 years has never happened.
Mock will salvage much of this year's corn crop, chopping it up for cattle feed. But he says the drought shows just how tenuous farming is on the Arkansas River in eastern Colorado.
My water comes from 200 miles away on top of a mountain down a dirt ditch to get to my farm. When water gets short, that's not very economical. And so the guy irrigating out of the Arkansas River, his days are numbered.
On east another 70 miles, and the Arkansas has crossed into Kansas, where it's spelled the same but pronounced differently.
Standing down here just south of Lake in Kansas under a bridge that purports to span the Arkansas River. However, there's no river down here, not even a hint of water. Just dry sand stretching for miles. There's a rotting deer carcass. A couple of guys shooting guns.
Jaron Bell here and his friend are both 16, Lakin boys.
Does it ever seem kind of depressing that there's no water in this river?
Sometimes. It'd be nice to come down here and play in it when it's hot.
It's hot today.
Yeah.
There's not much relief from the heat in western Kansas, and that's especially true of the treeless ranch land south and east of Lakin.
My name is Nathan Pike, and we're located 10 miles south of Mineola.
Ranch life seems to agree with Nate Pike. He's rough and spry despite a host of maladies and serious injuries over his 78 years. He's lived and raised cattle on the squinty, low hills here since the Dust Bowl.
Well, I was born in a drought, and I've been through several. But this one is probably the most damaging one I've seen. I've never seen buffalo grass die, and it has.
Empty rolling prairie stretches for miles in all directions from a rise on Pike's ranch, where he kneels to touch a sea of stubby, burnt grass, dried almost to the shade of his straw cowboy hat.
You can see what we're up against. This old stuff is no good at all, and we're in a fire hazard.
Pike had to sell off the bulk of his cattle. He couldn't feed them. He's got fewer now than at any time in the last 50 years. And since he sold, cattle prices have gone up. As for what that means for his future or for rebuilding the family cattle operation?
We don't know. We got to get some rain. That's what we got to get.
But there's no rain in the immediate forecast, just parching triple-digit highs as the worst drought in memory along the Arkansas River Basin intensifies. Frank Morris, Harvest Public Media.
Casey Currents wants to know how this severe weather is affecting your day-to-day life. Give us a call at 816-235-6696. That's 816-235-6696, and leave a message. Tell us your name, how to spell it, and where you're calling from.
The bucking bull has long been the embodiment of the American rodeo. Brute animal strength in a contest with a cowboy trying desperately to stay on the bull's back. Within the last 10 years, bucking bulls have become a major industry, with the price of the best bloodline soaring up to $250,000, and competitions from Madison Square Garden to Wyoming. As Laura Ziegler reports, the bucking bull business is gaining the money and prestige once reserved for horse racing.
It takes just 4 seconds for a strong young bull to reap its owner as much as $50,000 in prize money. 4 seconds is how long each 1 and 2 year old bull will wear a weight strapped to their back. Each one of the massive animals will be judged on how high they kick and how much they twist.
You know, we're trying to breed our bulls to be more athletic build.
Randy Shippey is a slight man in an orange T-shirt that says House of Jesus. He owns Shippey Rodeo Bulls in Colombe, South Dakota. He's got 7 bulls in this regional competition, used to get young bulls ready for the contest with higher prizes. A massive 2-year-old bull thrusts his back legs in a killer kick against the metal walls of the chute, defying 4 brawny cowboys trying to place a blue box known as a dummy on his back. By throwing off the box, the bull's learning what it's like to throw weight from his back. It's supposed to get him ready to throw off a determined cowboy in a year or two. Shippey says training bulls this way is only one new thing about the sport.
In the old days when they were raising rodeo cattle, you know, it was longhorns because they wanted horns and color. And, you know, we're trying to, you know, get animals that have lots of kick, speed, intensity, you know, where they're really whipping. And so, I mean, them are things that we look for.
This next bull out is going to be 1008 Pork Chop from Ramey Divot.
Over the past 10 years, prize money in the bucking bull business has increased tenfold, industry officials say, because of the combination of more sponsors, greater competition, and television contracts. Tony Weborg owns this bullpen and ring.
People like coming to bull ridings. You know, businesses know that, you know. Bull ridings, they draw a good crowd. So, you know, they get a lot of bang for their buck.
I'd like to thank our general sponsors, West Point Livestock Auction, Countryside Photography out of Pender, Nebraska, Lawrence and Lumber out of Pender.
The national bucking bull competitions, of course, attract weightier sponsors. Ford, Stanley Tools, Evan Williams Bourbon. The industry's also grown as major networks sign on to air bucking bull events. Matt Sharping, a Minnesota genetics company executive whose stiff collar looks a bit out of place in the dusty ring, gets publicity from a bull he co-owns with All-Pro defensive end Jared Allen. The winnings support Allen's charity to help wounded soldiers.
I went to him and I said, you know, I think this could be a great fit for you, you know, that we could, you know, raise some money for the charity. And that's what we've done. And since March, we've raised $33,000. The bull industry has.
The bucking bull industry has grown by 500%, according to the Professional Bucking Bull Association. Entry fees are up, and prizes are 10 times larger than they were 10 years ago. Spectators and investors here in Pender, Nebraska, know they might not win big. In fact, they might lose what they've spent on the sport, but it's the challenge, they say, even the romance of literally rubbing shoulders with an enormous bull, an icon of the rodeo, that inspires them.
My other business bankrolled some of this hobby I have with the bucking bulls.
So, has it paid off?
Probably not. I mean, what I've invested in my money over the years, yeah, I haven't gotten all my money back yet.
Ivan Stolfus knows this is an expensive, high-risk hobby. But as the stakes keep growing, more people like him are getting into the game, in turn making the stakes grow even higher. For example, the Professional Bull Riders Association says its world championship in Las Vegas this fall will pay its top winners $2 million. For KCUR News, I'm Laura Ziegler.
After the break, a Raytown South graduate and his family prepare for the Olympics. This is Casey Currents.
This is Casey Currents. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith. Ever hear a news story and feel like you just walked in during the middle of a movie? Who's who? How did it start? And why does it matter? Some news stories take months or years to unfold, and if you miss a few updates, you might get lost. That's why we've started a new series called Break It Down, to help make sense of a complex issue. This week, it's Kansas K-12 school funding.
Last month, a 3-judge panel in Topeka heard a case in which 54 school districts sued the state for cutting their funding. The state has budgeted $38 million per student for the coming school year. That's down $500 per student from 4 years ago, and many Kansas teachers say it's nowhere near the amount needed to properly educate students. But K-12 education takes up half the state's threadbare budget, say many legislators. And with state revenues dropping dramatically, something's got to give. Peter Hancock has been covering the issue for the Kansas Education Policy Report. He explained it to Alex Smith, starting with the Kansas school's funding formula.
It's called the base state aid per pupil. And every year the legislature appropriates a certain amount of money to provide a uniform per pupil amount, more or less uniform across all school districts. That's what their general fund budget is. So there's a set amount per weighted pupil, and that gets a little complicated because at-risk students, for example, are counted as 1.5 students. English language learners are counted. There are weighting factors for different kinds of students, reflecting the fact that it costs more to educate them than it does a middle-class child with no handicaps or anything of that sort. In addition to that, local school districts have the ability to levy a certain amount of local taxes above and beyond what the state provides them. It's called the local option budget, or LOB. So those are the two main pots of money that school districts deal with.
And then is there federal money on top of that?
There is quite a bit of federal money. Most of that, though, is earmarked for specific programs. A very large portion of federal money comes in for school lunches, for example. There's also what's called Title I money, which is money for schools and for districts that serve a high number of low-income students, money that goes directly to poverty-stricken areas. There are other kinds of money. There's special education money. The federal government funds a certain percentage of all the special education services. So there's a great deal of federal money that comes into Kansas, but it's typically earmarked for very specific programs.
So right now we're currently in the middle of a pretty big lawsuit about school funding, but this is sort of following a previous big court case over school funding. What happened with that case?
In 2005, the Kansas Supreme Court upheld a lower court ruling that said the state of Kansas was not providing suitable funding for public schools. The Kansas Constitution says that the legislature shall make suitable provision for finance of the educational interests of the state. That's basically been construed to mean that the state has to provide suitable funding and that the schools have to provide a suitable education. And as a result of that case called Montoy versus Kansas, the legislature was ordered to drastically increase the amount of money that they were spending on public schools. It resulted until about 2008, 2009, in about $750 million a year in additional funding above and beyond what had been spent before. It also resulted in some of those weighting factors to make sure that money was going to districts that have the highest needs students. There was increased funding for the at-risk students, and there was also a thing called high-density at-risk, which basically targeted urban inner-city schools where you not only have poverty, but in a highly concentrated, densely populated area like Kansas City and Wichita and Topeka.
So were there quantifiable results in the higher funding? I mean, are students learning more, getting better that we can measure?
Some people would say yes, that as a result of that funding, test scores did go up, particularly among minority groups, low-income students, special education students, and that was because with that additional money, the inner-city schools and the high-poverty schools were able to hire more teachers to reduce class sizes. They were able to provide after-school programs, tutoring programs, things that were specifically targeted to meet the needs of these difficult-to-teach populations. As a result of that, test scores went up. And in addition, the State Board of Education would tell you that the gap, what's called the achievement gap, between disadvantaged and non-disadvantaged students began to narrow quite substantially.
So why are the districts now suing again?
The allegation is, the basis of the lawsuit is that since the stock market crash and the financial collapse of 2008, the state of Kansas has drastically cut back on funding for education through direct cuts ordered by both Governor Mark Parkinson at the time and also cuts ordered by now Governor Sam Brownback. The legislature has appropriated less, and so that base aid per pupil amount went down from about $4,400 per pupil down to $3,780 per pupil this past year, as close to a 15% cut. Now, this coming year, they did provide a modest little increase of about $48 or $50 per pupil, so it went back up a little bit. But basically, what the plaintiffs are saying is that it is well below what it actually costs to provide an education.
So are these districts that are suing, are they mostly rural, are they urban, or are they both?
It's a mix of urban and rural school districts. Kansas City, Kansas, one of the very large school districts, is in the lawsuit. Wichita, the largest school district in the state, is in there. So are a number of smaller districts. But they tend to be districts with high poverty rates, a large number of minority students, the very difficult to teach populations. Those are the plaintiffs. It's essentially the same group that filed the Montoy case. However, there are fewer districts in this suit than in the Montoy case, in part because there was huge political backlash from taxpayers in school districts, from the state legislature, about public school districts using public funds to sue the state to claim they weren't getting enough public funds. That was a very politically sticky situation. There was also a lot of backlash in Montoy against the Kansas Supreme Court. It resulted in a special session in 2005 when the legislature dug in its heels, particularly the conservative Republicans who led the House dug in their heels and said the Supreme Court cannot order the legislature to appropriate a specific amount of money. And the Supreme Court handed out a preliminary order that said if you don't comply with the Supreme Court ruling, we will close public schools. Now, it was in July, so it's kind of easy to close public schools in July, but there was a tense situation there for a while where there was a fear that the schools might not be able to open in August or September because the legislature was going to refuse to appropriate the money. In the end, calmer heads prevailed. The legislature did appropriate the money, but I would say that since then there are still a lot of lingering resentment at the Supreme Court for that order and a feeling that the Supreme Court really sort of encroached on legislative authority, the whole separation of powers thing.
This is Casey Currents. We're talking with Peter Hancock of the Kansas Education Policy Report about school finance. Lawyers for the district presented studies that monetize the actual cost of educating kids effectively. How can you measure that?
There is actually a raging debate in the academic community right now about how you measure the cost of a suitable education. One of the things that the plaintiffs will argue is what defines suitable. Since the early 1990s, when Kansas and most states shifted to a different way of accrediting schools, it's called outcomes-based education, or here in Kansas we call it quality performance accreditation, or QPA. And that's where schools are judged and accredited based on how well the students perform on standardized tests. It used to be that they were accredited on the basis of how many books you had in the library and how many teachers you had in the classroom and whether the teachers were all certified, and inputs-based accreditation. Now it has become outcomes-based education, and so the plaintiffs will argue that suitable funding is the amount of funding it takes to meet these expectations under the QPA law of Kansas and under quality, under the federal No Child Left Behind Act. There is, however, a raging debate going on about how much money and what the correlation is between spending and student outcomes. In the Montoy case, there was evidence presented that said it takes, you know, for every $1 increase in the base funding amount, you could expect to see X% increase in test scores. There's now considerable debate about whether or not you can draw that correlation. Clearly, it takes something. You can't fund schools with $1 and expect them to meet those outcomes. But how much of an increase it takes to produce these outcomes is very much in debate right now, and that's one of the issues that the three-judge panel is wrestling with as they try to decide the case.
Meanwhile, the State Board of Education just put in a request for $440 million to aid schools, which will be considered by the legislature and the governor next year. Do you think that increase will make a difference?
If the legislature funds it, it would make a substantial difference. The question is, will the legislature fund it and will the governor support it? We're in that time of year now where it's kind of odd. The legislature has just passed a budget for the new fiscal year that just started on July 1st. That's about the time when all the state agencies start putting together their budget requests for the next fiscal year. It's a process where they put in a request to the administration. The administration says, well, here's what we're willing to endorse. There's an appeal process. And that results in, sometime in December, the governor putting together his proposed budget that he submits to the legislature. What the state board requested is based actually on current law. The law says that the base state aid per pupil amount is supposed to be $4,492. It's not. It's substantially less than that. But almost the next line in the statute says, however, if the legislature does not appropriate enough money to fund $4,492 per pupil, then what they do appropriate is then prorated out to each of the school districts. What the state board did was to say, essentially, fund the law. The law says it should be $4,492. That was based on professional estimates at the time about what the costs should be, factoring in inflation over a period of time. And they say that fund the law is what the state board said. And there was a lot of discussion on the board about whether to go in that direction. There are people on the board who thought by making that request, they are making themselves irrelevant in the legislature, that nobody will take that seriously, and they will probably be blocked out of any negotiations that go on after the governor's initial request. There are others on the board who say it is their primary duty to be advocates for the school district and to advise the legislature and administration about what they think is best for public schools. That latter side won out in this particular vote, and I think it was a 6-2 or 7-2 vote to go ahead and request the full amount. That would be a very substantial increase. The school districts will tell you that they need that money. There are school districts, Kansas City and Wichita, where teachers who don't get paid a whole lot to begin with have not seen a raise in 4 years. They have downsized, laid off teachers, increased class sizes. They've had to cancel or cut back on those after-school programs, those tutoring programs and things that help disadvantaged students, and they will tell you as a result of those cuts, you're going to start to see, this coming year, you're going to start to see test scores declining. Actually, the test scores that they just administered last year, we won't know the official results of them until about September, but they say based on their preliminary analysis, you're already seeing test scores declining. So they would like to go back to being able to rehire teachers, reduce class sizes, get those at-risk programs targeted for at-risk students, get those back up and running, and get back on track to raising test scores and bringing all of those students up to proficiency.
All right. Well, Peter Hancock, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Alex.
The three-judge panel will hear final arguments in the school funding case in late August. Hancock says he expects a decision around November, but that could come before or after the election. No matter what the decision, it will probably be appealed.
On last week's KC Currents, just before three-time world champion Jerome Wooten took another trip to the championships, he gave Alex Smith a reporting tip and a prediction.
You should have asked me, am I going to win this year? And the answer would have been yes, thus I am going to win this year.
And he was right. Wooten went on to win first place last week in the adult single division of the World Championship of Dominoes in Andalusia, Alabama. He also took sixth place in adult doubles with partner Timothy Webster of Jacksonville, Florida.
You can hear more about Kansas City's Dominoes Champs in our audio archives at kcur.org, along with any other stories you may have missed. And you can hear this show there, plus we've got a podcast. Find us on iTunes.
A couple of weeks ago, Harvest Public Media started a new series called My Farm Roots. These are American stories and memories of rural life. Harvest Public Media's editor, Donna Vestal, has the latest installment.
I recently tracked down Tom Karst, the national editor for The Packer, a trade newspaper covering the fruit and vegetable industry. For more than 25 years, he's been reporting about issues of importance to the produce industry, such as immigration, farm policy, and food safety. I actually worked with Karst at The Packer after graduating from college in the 1980s, and I always wondered how he managed to connect so well with farmers across the country. So in an interview at his office in a suburb of Kansas City, I asked Karst about his own connection to the land.
My name's Tom Karst. I'm national editor of The Packer. My dad grew up in wheat country near Galicia, Kansas, in Russell, Kansas. And so my uncle Art was a farmer. My dad was an Air Force pilot, so he wasn't involved with farming, but we went back to Galicia, and so just to see the wheat harvest. One summer, I helped Uncle Art with that. My mom was widowed, and she married a farmer in Nebraska when I was a senior in high school. And, you know, although our family had, you know, through our grandparents had farming background, when I was a senior in high school, we actually moved to a farm in Nebraska.
What did you do on the farm?
Typical things, you know, drive the tractor, irrigate, you know, which is, you know, going out in the morning and the evening and gated pipe. I don't know if you've ever seen that, but aluminum pipe that's set along the edge of the field, and you open every other gate to irrigate the rows of corn, and then in the evening you'd switch the gates so that, you know, the other row got the water. So
do they still do it that way?
A lot of the irrigation has moved to pivot.
Right.
So that saves a lot of labor, and you know, you can cover a lot more ground that way. Just work from really dawn to dusk. We'd come in for lunch at 10 o'clock, which, you know, you'd have to get used to all the breaks that they'd have. Like the 10 o'clock break, and then we had the dinner, which was lunch, and then you had coffee at 4 o'clock. So your day was broken up, but you definitely worked the whole day. And so I don't know if I could have done farming as a profession, because I don't know if I'm cut out for that necessarily, but there's nothing to beat just going out the door and having work to do. The work is right there for you, and you come back and you're at your, you know, you're still at your home. And so in that way, it's different lifestyle. It's a kind of enviable lifestyle, I think, just to be there, you know, with your family on the farm, and you've got everything in front of you that has to be done. So and then you come in and have a 10 o'clock break and a 4 o'clock.
To hear more My Farm Roots stories or to share your own, visit harvestpublicmedia.org/myfarmroots.
On July 1st, local track star Maurice Mitchell qualified for something many athletes desire but few ever reach, the Olympics. The former Raytown South runner will travel to London to represent the United States and compete against stars like Usain Bolt. Casey Current's Zach Lewandowski spoke to Maurice over the phone as he was getting ready to leave for London.
Coming around the last turn of the 200-meter men's sprint in Oregon, Maurice Mitchell was giving himself a little advice.
I told myself to stay relaxed and just finish strong. And when I crossed that finish line, I was pretty much zoned out. I didn't really know whether I qualified or really what happened. But when I crossed that finish line and I see my name come up at second place, I was speechless, really.
He was speechless because the 22-year-old had just changed his dreams into reality. Mitchell's second-place finish in the Olympic trials run cemented his place on the 2012 U.S. Olympic team. Mitchell would have the chance to wear the stars and stripes to represent his country as one of the best sprinters in the world.
I was just really, really shout for joy. It still really hit me now, so I'm still excited.
Maurice had come a long way since he was a kid running around the block of his Raytown neighborhood. From an early age, it was clear that Maurice had unique abilities. Maurice's father, Michael Mitchell, says it didn't take long for Maurice to start breaking records.
Let's go back to middle school when he broke the middle school record in the 100 and the 200. He saw all the attention he was getting, staff members and kids at the school. And for some reason, it dawned on him, this is a pretty nice accomplishment to have broken somebody's record who's never run this fast ever in the city of Raytown. And then I think he started developing a mentality. I'm going to see if I can go ahead and start trying to get better and try to do something with this God-given talent.
The early success continued through high school at Raytown South, where Maurice would become an 8-time state champion in the 100, 200, and 400-meter races. He won the Missouri Gatorade Track and Field Athlete of the Year 3 years in a row, from 2006 to 2009, and was considered the number one collegiate recruit in the Kansas City area for his junior and senior seasons.
Everything just keeps on snowballing. The more it seems like he accomplishes, the more he feels he's wanting to get on the track and continue to work hard and make himself better.
By the end of his high school career, Maurice was getting scholarship offers from several universities. He chose Florida State, but the move from the heartland to the coast was not easy.
It was tough, obviously, being far away from home. You know, it was really, I got homesick from time to time. The transition was really rough. The training was definitely different, was a different level than it was in high school. It took a while for me to finally adjust to the weight training and the way the coach trained.
Despite his initial concerns, Maurice continued his furious pace of record-breaking runs. He became the first athlete to win 3 consecutive honors as the ACC Indoor Track Performer of the Year. He was the NCAA champion in the 200-meter dash outdoor event. And all the while, his parents were watching from the stands. Maurice's father had learned a lesson from his younger days, when he would often look up into the stands and see nothing but bleachers staring back.
You know, I grew up playing athletics and being involved in athletics, and my folks didn't come and support me at all. I was out there on the island, you know, and when I needed encouragement and when I needed somebody to say, hey, you can do it, somebody to hug me, whether I did well or not, I think it would have gone a long way. And then when I got older and started having children, I vowed to myself that I was going to make sure as much as I possibly could to be there for my kids.
Maurice's parents were a familiar sight at his national competitions. So when Maurice qualified for the Olympics, it seemed only natural that his parents would come with him. But the 2012 Olympics are held in London, and the trip across the sea was too much of a financial burden. The Mitchells needed help, and the community of Raytown responded. A fund was set up through the Raytown Lee Summit Credit Union to raise $5,000 for Maurice's family by July 31st. Raytown South High School hosted a car wash Saturday to help raise money for Mitchell's fund. And the Mitchells certainly appreciated the help.
Well, let me tell you, the community has been phenomenal. I am just overwhelmed with gratitude about how people have reached out to see to it that my family and I get an opportunity to go to London. We probably wouldn't have had an opportunity to go without them.
I was pretty much new to the fact that my parents were coming, and it's really exciting for everyone back in Kansas City to support my family like they are. And I'm just really looking forward for my parents being there and that being their first time going overseas and seeing me make the Olympic team.
But the support shouldn't come as a surprise. The successful track career for Maurice has translated into somewhat of a celebrity status in the city of Raytown.
People stop us, talk to us, give us so much congratulatory comments, hugging us, experience so much excitement. It's almost like we ourselves as a family have taken on a celebrity kind of mantle here because of what Maurice has accomplished.
For Mitchell, everything seems to be coming together in the last year. He was married to fellow Florida State track athlete Tiara Swanigan in December, and she became pregnant in March. The two are expecting a baby boy in December. Now all that seems left is a spot on the podium of the Olympic Games. Michael believes seeing his son with a medal around his chest would be the perfect ending.
Oh, it would be unbelievably gratifying, and it would just bring the family so much pride.
The opening ceremonies for the Olympics begins this Friday. For Casey Currents, I'm Zach Lewandowski.
After the break, have a look at Casey's Fringe Festival. This is Casey Currents.
This is Casey Currents. I'm Alex Smith.
And I'm Susan Wilson.
In area news this week, Kansas City revised its billboards ordinance, Fire Chief Smokey Dyer announced his retirement, and as the drought continued, residents across the metro area were asked to cut back on water use. Steve Bell recaps those and other top stories of the week on KCUR's Weekend News Review.
By midweek, every county in Missouri and 82 in Kansas were officially drought disaster areas. Grass fires, water main breaks, and forest fires became a concern. Rick Case, Assistant Forest Management Officer for the Mark Twain National Forest, said many fires are being started by mowing.
They're hitting a rock with a piece of metal, and the fuels are so dry that it's actually sparking fires in the fields.
Megan Cobby with Water One, which serves 400,000 area customers on the Kansas side of the state line, said water consumption has hit twice that of a typical summer.
Don't water during the heat of the day. Try and water between 4 a.m. and 8 a.m. or again in the evening after 6 p.m.
The heat also brought complaints of hot, thirsty deer and raccoons foraging in the cities, and several people were bitten by snakes made restless by the heat. A tragic Edgerton murder case was solved quickly, but it didn't ease the heartache for family members now taking care of the children of sisters Brittany Harrop and Ashley Key. Clifford Miller of Trimble, Missouri, admitted he went to Harrop's home while high on meth and killed the two young women.
I will review the case to determine whether the state will seek the death penalty in this case.
Platte County Prosecutor Eric Zond, who said the claim of drug impairment is not allowable as a defense in Missouri. A Missouri judge terminated the parental rights of a Guatemalan woman whose son was adopted by a Carthage couple 4 years ago after she was caught in an immigration sweep. Marcia Zug, family immigration law specialist, said the ruling was disappointing but not surprising.
A lot of times undocumented immigrants have a lot of strikes against them. They're usually poor, usually uneducated, don't speak English, all of these types of things that don't meet sort of the stereotypical definition of a good parent.
The boy's mother, Encarnacion Bale Romero, will appeal the decision. The city council revised Kansas City's billboard ordinance so that companies don't have to give up sign locations condemned for eminent domain. Carol Winteroad of Citizens Against Billboard Blight said the plan became more acceptable after the council resolved to police billboard restrictions more aggressively and consider a 2% billboard tax.
I'm hoping the city will reap lots of money that can be used for beautification and could be used to remove a billboard that has been condemned.
Under the revised ordinance, owners would still have to do away with equivalent square footage of signs in other locations. Kansas City Fire Chief Smokey Dyer confirmed that he will retire, effective July 30th, and that 29 chiefs and supervisors will also.
You can't lose that kind of experience without having a significant impact.
The city council recently cut $7.5 million from next year's fire department budget. And Kansas City got the final report on the All-Star Game. It drew 150,000 out-of-towners, pumped up hotel revenues by $2 million in 2 days, and drew as many to the Negro Leagues Museum in 2 weeks as usually visit in a month. The only disappointment, attendance at the Fan Fest didn't top that in St. Louis 3 years ago. This is KCUR.
Casey Currents' Sylvia Maria Gross has covered the adoption case of Guatemalan Encarnacion Bale Romero over the past 2 years. You can hear those stories on kcur.org.
This year marks the 8th annual KC Fringe Festival. Though the festival is increasingly drawing groups from outside the area, over half of this year's 90 performance and film offerings originated with Missouri-based artists, and a quarter hail from Kansas. KCUR's Steve Walker looks at two shows in particular that explore distinct events or locales in our adjacent states.
The thing about the Kansas City Fringe Festival that makes it such a draw is the variety of genres, from theater and dance to film and burlesque, exemplifying that anything goes spirit, are two shows with subject matter that will be familiar to most residents of the region. The Warrensburg-based company Smashing Frames returns to the Fringe with Missouri Momentum Times 3, a triptych of short pieces whose style is explained by co-founder Julie Mollenkamp.
They all have a backdrop of multimedia, including visual images as well as soundscapes as well as video. Some of the text is recorded, some of the text is spoken live in conjunction with that. So it's literally scored. Then we add live both sound effects as well as text to it.
One of the three is about incidents of bullying in various Missouri towns. Another, People Speak, about how the Occupy Wall Street movement played out in Kansas City and St. Louis, was devised by Mollenkamp students at Central Missouri State University. Mollenkamp explains the genesis of the third piece, Gust, about the May 2011 Joplin tornado.
The visuals of Gust are twofold. It's all video, and the first half of it is the streets of Joplin, downtown areas, rural areas, before the tornado of May 2011. And then the tornado happens, and the second half is video projection of the streets of downtown Joplin and rural areas after.
National Weather Service has issued
we didn't know
warning.
Where the other shelters were.
We had an opportunity to speak to several people who had survived that tornado and several people who lost family members and friends. And one of the main reasons we wanted to do it, and sort of the upshot of Gust, is to tribute those who survived and those who lost their lives, but also to remind all of us that we live in Tornado Alley and that we need to have a plan. What are you going to do if the tornado sirens go off?
Working in a much lighter vein are life partners Suzanne Welch and Jim Sturgill, who've turned their love of the NPR show Prairie Home Companion into Prairie Village Home Companion. Sturgill says it's both self-deprecating and a little mocking about such suburban staples as housing covenants.
So things like your grass needs to be so long, your house needs to be painted one of four acceptable colors. The positive spin is that you buy into a set of ideals of what you want the neighborhood to look like. The rules, the enforced tyranny of the masses, I guess. Pretty clear that this is all done tongue-in-cheek and with a sense of humor to them.
Along with a house band and folk commercials is Private Eye Pierre Black, a play on Garrison Keillor's Guy Noir, who here chats with a client about her missing husband.
When did he go missing?
45 minutes ago, just after dinner. When I finished cleaning the kitchen, I went into the den and he was just gone.
45 minutes is hardly a missing person, Mrs.
Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Black. I'm January. January Kenworth.
Your husband is Ken Kenworth?
Yes, Kenneth Kenworth III. I'm sure you've heard of the Kenworths. We're one of Prairie Village's founding families.
I'm not familiar with the history of Prairie Village, ma'am. I'm actually from Olathe.
Oh, goodness, Olathe. Mm.
In addition to Prairie Village Home Companion, Sturgill and Welch will emcee Iron Artists, where Fringe performers compete to create a new work in an hour. Steve Walker, KCUR News.
Both Prairie Village Home Companion and Missouri Momentum Times 3 will be performed at the Unicorn Theater during the KC Fringe Festival, which runs through July 29th.
And another look at what's to come for the KC Fringe Fest. The festival has been described as daring, providing an opportunity for artists to take risks and challenge themselves. In recent years, local actors have tried their hand at directing, and directors have taken up acting. KCUR's Laura Spencer reports on two artists crafting something new from the past.
One that April, with his showy sorta.
Maybe it's been since high school, or that British literature class you took in college, since you heard this prologue from Chaucer's The Canterbury Tales, a 14th century collection of stories told by traveling pilgrims.
One Zephyrus, ek with his sweeter breath, inspired hath in every halt and heath the tendra croppes.
And no, my production's not in Middle English, but the blueprint is the same.
Ryan Kincaid is aware his audience will range from expert to novice when it comes to the Canterbury Tales, but he's updated some of the stories with original music and lyrics for a new rock musical called Pilgrimage.
I thought the knight was very chivalric but representative of the people, so it's like a Springsteen-esque anthem. And the Miller is kind of a funky and raunchy tale that represents not only the miller, but also the tale that he tells.
At an evening rehearsal, a loud fan blows into the unair-conditioned basement of the Arts Asylum, a cavernous space in an old church at 9th and Harrison. The show's large cast of actors and musicians sits in chairs or stands, some playing instruments, as Amy Kelly, with a mic in hand, works the room like a lounge singer. Bob Paisley, founder of Central Standard Theater, directs the production. He says it's the dialogue, the interaction of the characters between the songs, that stitches the show together. Paisley says it's full of potential, perfect to launch at the Fringe.
That's what we're all here for, to explore the boundaries of the art as best we can.
In the Crossroads Arts District in the small black box theater of the Fish Tank, actor Katie Kalaherka cues up the music for the song Look Me Over Closely.
And it comes directly after a little scene with a waitress who has spilled hot tea. Marlene Dietrich comes back in to teach one of her lessons in the form of this song.
Look me over closely. Tell me what you find, but don't get over anxious. I'm not the marrying kind.
Kalaherka's new one-woman show called Lessons from Marlene was inspired by a bad breakup, and a wedding provides the framework. She plays more than a dozen characters, including actress-singer Marlene Dietrich as an angel, who also serves as the MC of the cabaret.
This Marlene Dietrich is wild. She is part angel, part devil. She is all over the map, and she is very much more a caricature of Marlene Dietrich than very true to Marlene Dietrich. Mostly, I'm Marlene Dietrich, and Marlene adds different pieces. So Marlene might get a scarf, and she turns into an Irish girl named Laura. She might get a pair of glasses, she turns into a Trekkie named Rosie.
Or an English girl named Unid.
It's amazing what $100 can buy you. Today I went to the Dollar General. Have you heard of it? In attempting to rebuild a life, it is imperative that one be conscious of money. Breaking up is expensive, but with a good head on your shoulders, you can do it on the cheap. Need 100 things? Cost $100. It's that simple.
Actor Vanessa Severo directs the production, and Kalaherka says she's helped to shape it.
It's totally wacky and totally comedic, but she has helped me find even more nuggets of gold within the script that I didn't even know existed. We click very well.
Kalaherka has appeared on many local stages, and this marks her fifth appearance at Casey Fringe, but it's her first in her own production.
Fringe is a safe place to produce new work, and it's a safe place to even start a new work that could be a springboard for something different in the future. And ideally, I look at this piece as that.
Laura Spencer, KCUR News.
Pilgrimage at the Lyrics Opera Center and Lessons from Marlene at the Fish Tank run through July 29th as part of the 8th annual KC Fringe Festival. 6 tips for fringing and more can be found on our website at kcur.org. Just click on Arts and Culture. We thank you much for tuning in to KC Currents. This show will be archived along with all of our past shows on the KC Currents page at kcur.org.
You can also hear individual stories there or sign up for our podcast or find us on iTunes. Contact us at kccurrents@kcur.org or on Twitter at kccurrents.
KC Currents is produced by Alex Smith and Suzanne Hogan. Our senior producer is Sylvia Maria Gross. Our intern is Zach Lewandowski. And our theme music is by Approach. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith.